The recording begins 10 minutes into the presentation on page 8.
And how you compute the Brownian noise, you see that the distribution of bulk and shear elastic energy that comes into play when you are studying the ring down measurement or when you're studying the Brownian noise is actually quite different, because in the case of the ring down measurement, the combination of elastic bulk and shear energy is determined by the motion of by the shape of the molds, and in the case of the Brownian noise, instead, is determined by the shape of the probing beam on top on the surface of the mirror. So it means that in the two cases, there is a different averaging, a different combination of bulk and shear energy that comes into play. And so it's not really possible to describe a multilayer as an effective medium and as an effective single layer and determine directly loss angles from the ring down measurement and using directly those loss angles for the Brownian noise. And there are more details in this next slide if you want to actually look and see what those equations means. But you can see in the left side what is the expression for the power dissipated in a ring down for what. So this is what we measure in our Q measurement in our resonators, and then on the right side you can see what is the actual combination that comes into play in the case of the Brownian noise measurement. So at the end of the day, the message is that it's not really possible, not really useful or possible to measure directly the Q values of a resonator with a multilayer stack. And the simplest and more robust way to estimate Brownian noise is to just look at a single layer of materials that can you can describe the Q values of a resonator coated with this thin film in terms of bulk and shear loss angles, and then you should use those properties that you measure on the single layers together with the other elastic properties of those materials to compute Brownian noise and given the design of the stack that you are considering. And an important note here is that the Brownian noise depends not only on the loss angles but also on the elastic properties of the Young modulus and the Poisson ratio of the material. So those are also two important informations that need to be used to compute properly the Brownian noise. So what we did then is to have single layer of titanium of germania and silica deposited on the 75 millimeter diameter and 1 millimeter thick discs. And those are our standard substrates, standard resonator that we used for our ring down measurements. And then you can actually build a model of the elastic properties of the materials, and then you can fit the Q value you measure of all the resonant modes of these disks with bulk and shear models of the loss angles of the materials. And what we did was to compare six different ways the bulk and shear loss angle might depend on frequency. So either a power law, a linear dependency, or constant as a function of frequency. And this gives you three different models shown here. And then you can also assume either different bulk and shear loss angle or assume equal bulk and shear loss angle. And we fit the data with all with each one of those models. And then we can see which one of those models describe best the measurements. And the result is shown in this slide here, together with all the other properties that we extracted from our measurement and additional measurement of the material. So it turns out that for silica, the best description of the loss angles is a constant and equal bulk and shear at a level of about 2 × 10⁻⁵, which is pretty much in line with what has been found by other people in the literature. And instead, for titania doped germania, data really favor having a different behavior of the shear and bulk loss angle. In particular, the shear is, as you can see here, is almost constant, but the bulk loss angle has a quite steep frequency dependency, and it's significantly lower than the shear loss angle at the lower frequencies. A couple of notes here is that, first of all, our ring down measurements are able to access modes from 1 kilohertz above. So that's why in the plot here, everything below 1 kilohertz is dashed, because that's an extrapolation to lower frequencies of the measurement that is actually going up to down to 1 kilohertz. The other thing is, as soon as the bulk loss angle becomes significantly smaller than the shear loss angle, it doesn't really matter anymore how steep the frequency dependency is. All that matters is that you are dominated by the shear loss angle. So, for example, you can use the second most probable model to describe loss angle, which is a linear dependency of the bulk and shear loss angles with frequency, and you will still get a robust prediction that the bulk loss angle for titania doped germania is lower than shear, although it doesn't get as low and as steep because of the way the linear relationship is built. So we believe that those are some solid measurement and reasonable measurement of the bulk and shear loss angle. So those are values that we can use now to predict what is the Brownian noise once we have a design for the A-plus coatings. So this shows a very simple and in some sense preliminary design of what we can get for an ATM and an ETM stack. So the goal here was just to use as fewer layers as possible and hit the requirement for a transmission with the ITM of 1.4% at 1064 nanometers and a 5 ppm transmission for the ETM at 1064 nanometers. And as you can see in the graph here, the stack has been optimized to move away from a quarter wave length stack in order to hit the actual transmission requirement. Then you have two ways of doing that, and the one that we chose is the one that has less titanium doped germania, because that's still the material with a higher loss angle. So this stack here shows you that you can actually achieve the 1.4% transmission for the ITM with 22 layers and the 5 ppm transmission for the ETM with 52 layers. So those numbers are a little bit larger, roughly the double, I guess, or some around the double of the number of layers that are actually used with titanium tantala. And the reason is that the refractive index of titanium doped germania is a little bit lower. So you have less contrast, and you have to use more layers. So with this
really,
design,
can I ask a very naive question on this? Is the optic next to coating layer 1 or layer 22?
Oh, yeah. The 22 is the layer near to the substrate. And you can tell that because the layer number 1 is the half wavelength silica that you always cap at the end of the coatings.
Thanks.
Good question. Yeah, should add some note there. So using this design and the measure loss angles, you get this prediction for Brownian noise. So the total Brownian noise is given here by the green curve, and the shaded area is taking into account all the uncertainty of the measurement from the loss angle and the Young modulus, the Poisson ratio. Everything is factored in this area. So you can see that if you want to focus 100 Hertz, the predicted Brownian noise is 5.8 10 to the minus 21 meters over root Hertz, with more or less plus 1, minus 0.7 uncertainty. So the requirement for advanced LIGO plus is actually 6.6 10 to the minus 21 meters over root Hertz. So you can see that we are meeting that requirement. And also, this dashed curve here in the plot shows where the actual advanced LIGO Brownian noise is at least a factor of 10 below, I mean, more than a factor of 10 below the total noise. So when it's actually relevant, then you see that we are meeting that requirement everywhere. Of course, I have to stress again that this is an extrapolation of measurements that are above 1 kilohertz, and this is an extrapolation down. But nevertheless, it seems we are confident that this is a solid prediction of Brownian noise. Before we move on and discuss the tests we did with the multi-layer stacks, I want to show the results for the loss angle of the cutting edge coatings. So here, different concentrations have been studied. The goal was to cover between 40 and 50%, but actually you can see that the result was a little bit more spread around. So we got as low as 37% and as high as 72%. So those materials, the films deposited by cutting edge coatings behaved quite differently. So you can see from the graph here that, for example, the young modulus really change a lot after annealing at 550C, which is a typical sign that there is some big change in the material. And actually we could see even on a dark field microscope that those layers deposited on our 75 millimeter disks were crystallized after annealing at 550C. So this is just telling that this material behaved in a different way than the one that we saw deposited from Colorado State. So, and also you can see that even after annealing 500C, where the materials are still good, the loss angle is slightly larger than what we measured with the CSU films. So there are indications that these films behave in a different way. One possible explanation is that either the materials are, the composition is a little bit different, or it's also possible that fact that they crystallized sooner was due to the fact that the substrate and the coatings showed a lot of defects and they were not as clean as the one from CSU. So, you know, if you have more stuff into the coating, more defects, that could act as a seed for crystallization. So this concludes a little bit the discussion of the measurement we did on the single layers and how we predict the Brownian noise and why we think this is a very promising material. So the next natural step was to produce actually multi-layer stack of titania, dope germania, and silica. So we had a lot of stacks deposited by the Colorado State University group. And to be able to produce better optical quality stacks, the process was moved from the bias target system to a spector system, which is another ion beam sputtering, a standard commercial ion beam sputtering system that is very well used and known. And so the titania dope germania layers was deposited by simultaneous sputtering of germania and titania using not a mixed target, but using a germania target with some titania strips in front of it. And the reason for that is that the sputtering rate of germania and titania are quite different. So it was difficult to get a mixed target that got the right deposition. Silica was instead deposited from an oxide target. And all the parameters were tuned in order to obtain a refractive index close as possible to the one measured with the LANS bias target system. As you can see in the picture here, a first coating that gives you a 40 layers. So alternating, if you want 20 alternating doublets, as deposited, as shown, a very pristine mirror coating and a very high quality coating. This is also confirmed by some transmission electron microscopy and analysis of the layer. You can see that there are very well defined interfaces and the very slight intermixture of the material at the interfaces, but this is really as expected. So the as deposited layers shown very well defined interfaces and very good quality. There were also a lot of measurements of the optical absorption obtained by PCI of the HR stack. And so you can see here how the as deposited, both the as deposited and the annealed layers, stacks, showed very uniform absorption over a 10 millimeter line. And here, what has been measured after annealing at 600 C for 10 hours was an average absorption of about 3.4 ppm at 1 micron. So, as I already mentioned early, we know that optical absorptions are a parameter, are not an intrinsic parameter of the material, but are very much process dependent. And it's we don't think that 3.4 ppm is a limit of what we can get of this kind of stacks. Actually, if you mean asking with to people expert in using actually the spectral system and other deposition systems to make coatings, everybody agrees that getting to a few ppm absorption with a commercial spectral machine is quite good. And what we can say is also that as far as we know, either for tantala and titanium doptantala, LMA was able to get to sub ppm absorption for the mirrors, for the stacks, only when they use the grand coater and not on the spectral. So it seems that this level of absorption shows that there is no good reason to believe that we won't be able to go lower than this. So this doesn't mean that we are saying that an HR stack for this material will have a few ppm absorption. So we don't have to worry yet about this higher number, because we believe that once the process is moved to the grand coater or whoever will make the coating in a custom machine tuned for that, it will be possible to further reduce the optical absorption. So having a stack deposited, of course, were interested in having a direct thermal noise measurement. And this was possible using the system developed by the MIT group. There are some details here. I think that most of you are familiar on how that works, but it's basically a Fariparo cavity, and they can measure directly the thermal noise of the higher reflecting coating, provided that you actually have a high reflective coating that has a low enough transmission, scatter, and absorption losses. So there were a few measures done on the cutting edge coatings films, those stacks. And so that was the 44% titanium dopegermanium sample. Although, let me comment again that we saw different properties of the materials deposited by CSC with respect to CSU, so we can't really compare directly. So here, what has been seen is that annealing at high temperature, so 500 C, 600 or above, show the appearance of some of those bubbles of blistering effects, and I will come back to that later. Nevertheless, the MIT folks were able to measure the optical absorption and the thermal noise of some of these coatings even after annealing at 600 C. And you can see that after the first annealing, all absorptions, all optical loss went down. After 600 C, you can see that the scattering loss increased, and that's not surprising considering the amount of levels. But what's really interesting is that the absorption, the optical absorption loss really reduced a lot to a sub ppm value. So this has not yet been confirmed with a photothermal common path interferometry, but it's a very promising data point that shows that depending on the process, low optical absorption are actually possible. And this slide here shows you the very first measurement of thermal noise with those mirrors. So the green curve here is a reference from an advanced LIGO ETM witness samples. The red shows the titanium dopegermanium stack, the cutting edge coating stack as deposited, and the purple shows it as after annealing 600 C for 100 hours. So you see a reduction with respect to the advanced LIGO value, not as large as what we would expect. So you would expect a factor of 2 more or less from the advanced LIGO ETM, but you get a little bit less than that. Maybe you get to 0.75. So which is not as good as we would have liked, but you have, I mean, the point here is that first of all, you see all those bubbles and delamination, and that might have an effect also on the thermal on the actual thermal noise. And also, we were not able to measure the single layer films made by cutting edge coatings because they were crystallized after annealing at 550 C. So there's no direct comparison. So we don't know if actually the loss angles of those single layers after annealings were as low as the CSU films. So there is some indications that the materials might be a little bit different. Nevertheless, it's a first promising indication that we are moving in the right direction, and the thermal noise from these titanium of germania stacks is actually lower than advanced LIGO. On this slide, I have some more preliminary measurements of the optical assortions and the coated thermal noise of some of the CSU stacks that seems to have a larger coating thermal noise and even larger absorptions. But again, as I will show in the next slide, those were all stacks that were actually produced with the goal of trying to understand the formation and how to reduce those bubbles. So they were not really, the production of those materials were not really focused to achieve low optical absorption or the best possible Brownian noise. So those are just some preliminary numbers that are probably not very relevant for the actual prediction of thermal noise. So now it's about time that I focus the main issue remaining for those materials, which is the deformation of bubbles or delaminations. So what we saw is that when we anneal the multilayer at a temperature of 600 degrees C or even 500 for what matters. So when we anneal them at high temperature, we see some sort of delamination, so the formation of bubbles and blisters that can be quite large, as you can see in the left image here, or can be relatively small, as you can see in some of the dots in the right-hand side here. So the important comments here is that this is an effect that we see only in a multilayer, not in the single layers. And it seems that it's not an effect unique to this material, but it seems common to many, probably most of the sputtered oxide. And we just learned that it's also common to a silicon nitride where you have multilayer stacks. So here I'm going to give you some history of our observations. So initially, we deposited a 10-layer stack, and we annealed that at 600 C, and we saw no bubbles. And the 40 layers stack annealed at 600 C had very few defects and bubbles. And then the 52 layers showed a lot of bubbles, much more than the 40 layers. So this started to be a little bit confusing. So we started a systematic study on the dependence on the deposition and annealing parameters. However, I have to say that recently we observed a strong dependence on the quality of the substrate and the cleaningness and the cleaning procedure used to clean the substrate. So this might have really confused all those parametric studies. And those pictures that you see here, those are two nominally equal films. So they were deposited stacks that were deposited in the same run with the same procedure. And the only difference here is the fact that the film on the left side was deposited on a standard polished few silica samples, while the one on the left was deposited on a super polished surface, so with a much better surface RMS quality.
Good question there. Is the cleaning regime for those two exactly the same?
I will come back a little bit to that later. I believe so. And right now there are tests going on actually to see how much the cleaning regime can influence. But I believe that those two samples were produced with the same procedure and the same coating run.
Excellent, thank you.
So more on this dependency on substrate quality. And here you can quite see in a striking way on those pictures. So all the samples you see there on the six samples are all in the same picture on the center here, are all the same stack deposited under the same condition. The only difference being that the top four are standard surface polishing, nominally at 0.4 nanometers or a mass. And the two on the bottom are instead two super polished, so with less than 0.1 nanometer RMS. So you can see also quite a variability between, I mean, among the four substrates up there that are nominally the same. And we believe that even when you get some standard optical polish substrate that are normally from the same batch, the same manufacturer, the same batch, you might get quite a lot of difference in the actual quality. And so you see that there is quite a variability there. This is why we start to question all the systematic tests and all the observations of how bubbling and blistering depends on the deposition and annealing parameters, because we didn't control very well the surface quality. So there are tests going on now that are really focused on understanding how this surface quality and cleaningness affect the formation of bubbles. This means
if I could quickly ask, are you also changing the type of fusilica for those substrates? Looks like you have UV fusilica and then supercil for the super polished samples.
Yes, there's also... Also, the material of the substrate was also different. Yes, that could be another parameter, though we quite can't understand how the small difference in the properties of the different fusilica might have an effect. But that's something that is also a factor in the different studies. Okay. So that said, in the next couple of slides are some general, a long list of general observations of how many bubbles are forming with different kind of depositions and annealing tests. I don't want to go through all of them in details because that would take a long time. And you can take a look at them just to show that there's been a lot of contrasting and not very clear informations there, but there's a lot of work going on trying to understand how to reduce those bubbles. We believe now that probably the surface quality and the cleanliness are the most relevant parameters. So maybe it's not that useful to go through all of this information again. But here you can see different images of those bubbles and different informations on how, when they formed and the kind of tests that we did that cover stack thickness, a different annealing schedule, and how the surface was prepared. And as you can see, a different kind of different shapes and images of the bubbles. More ongoing here. Again, we believe now that the most important thing is related actually to the surface quality. So that's the most important things that we are trying to study now. I'll move on and briefly give you an idea of what is our understanding of why and how those bubbles form. So we have two main pictures here. One is a stress-induced. So we know that the films, when they are deposited, they have either compressive or tensile stress. And so there's a lot of literature there on how releasing the stress when you anneal can produce blistering. And the morphology of some of our small bubbles seems to resemble what in literature is known as compressive blistering. And so the main point here is to understand what are the sources of stress in the film. So there might be some intrinsic stress from the deposition, and also there might be some thermal expansion mismatch that will play a role during annealing. And those are parameters that have been studied. And for example, a lot of the initial tests were focused on producing silica with lower stress, because as I will show in the next slide, actually silica is the material. So we can just see that the silica single layer are the one that have the higher stress as deposit. So the CSU group worked a lot to try to reduce the stress in the material. The other possible picture for bubble formation is that there might be some trapping and aggregation of argon that is implanted during sputtering. And although there's a very low content in argon, this might also play a role. And of course, the two effect, the stress induced and the argon, are not completely orthogonal. They could act together to change what's going on. So concerning the stress, as I said, there were some tests in trying to figure out how to reduce the intrinsic stress of the as-deposited film. Although, as you can see here, the stress that is measured in the film after deposition are already in the few hundred megapascal, which is already quite low stress for these kind of films. Other sources of stress could come from the thermal expansion mismatch of the silica and the titanium doped germania. So we don't have, unfortunately, any literature measurement of the thermal expansion of titanium doped germania. And there is some indication that actually the titanium contributes some negative thermal expansion. And there might be the possibility that changing the concentration around the 44%, we might get some different behavior. We have some hints in this direction due to the fact that the measure, that there is some volume change after annealing of the films as deposited as a measurement with an ellipsometry. And so this seems to depend quite critical around that 40 to 50% concentration on the titania concentration. And so this is worth doing some more studies in the future. We imagine that changing a little bit the concentration around the 44% point shouldn't change too much the loss angle, but it might have an effect on the thermal expansion. So that might also help with this bubble problem. Concerning the argon diffusion, some RBS measurements were carried out to understand the evolution of the argon trapped into the silica and germania layer during annealing. So with a single layer, what you can see here in the left column is that annealing really takes basically all the argon out of the silica layer. And this is consistent with the diffusion of argon out of the single silica layer in the silica. Instead, it seems that in the case of the titanium doped germania, there isn't much change over annealing. The picture is a little bit more confusing and complex in the case of the multiple layer. And because it seems that there is the argon is actually trapped into the stack. So this is an interesting result. It's very new off the press, I would say. So there are a lot of experiments going on, diffusion experiment underway in argon-free atmosphere to actually clarify what's happening here. But this is just to give you an idea of that argon is also might also play a role in the formation of those bubbles. So with that, those are all the results that I wanted to show. I have now a few more slides that I put there mostly for reference and to address directly all the questions that we got from the panel in our emails. So I don't know if we want maybe to stop now and I can take some questions, or we can go through all those next slides. There aren't any new information there. It's just all the stuff that I already discussed put together in a more systematic way, addressing all the points one by one.
Thanks, Gabriele. Thanks very much, actually, for a very interesting presentation. Some hands have gone up, so I might suggest that we take, first of all, some questions. So I think, David, you were first.
Yep, thanks, Gabriele. It's a very, very interesting set of results. I imagine there's been some speculation about why it is that the super polished surface shows fewer bubbles. Two things come to mind. One is that there's something about the adhesion of the coating, which is better in the case of the super polished surface. Another one could maybe be that the super polishing reduces the argon that's embedded. Are those theories that you can shoot down immediately? Do you have others?
No, so those are both good suggestions. So you can imagine that the better quality of the surface means also a lower number of defects that can act as a seed. And also on top of that, it might also be true that when you clean the surface, it's easier to properly clean a super polished surface rather than a standard polished surface, again, because of the different level of roughness. So, but all your comments are actually good comments, and the tests that are going on right now are trying to be consistent and always use super polished samples just to have a consistent, better and consistent surface, and see if other parameters like the cleaning procedure or else play a role.
Thanks.
I think Helios was next.
Thanks a lot, Gabriele. The presentation was a high-level presentation. Thanks a lot. It was very interesting. I have a couple of curiosities, obviously, on the bubbles, on the bubbles theme. So the first one is, did you measure the element composition of the bubbles with an EDA, EDX, for example, or something else?
So those bubbles, as you see, they're really, we say bubbles would be more, they're small delamination. You can see on a microscope, and probably those are the best images, that there's actually the coating coming off. So there's not much left to measure after the thing actually burst, right?
Yeah, but maybe you can with an EDX you can understand if on the surface after the lamination there is some element that, for example, could come because my curiosity comes from the quality of the surface, because it looks like there is some dependence on the surface of the substrate. So this could be that there is some I don't know, some material pollution of or rest material that is stacking on top of the mirror that with the annealing can create some chemical reaction. And the second question, which is connected to this one, if you understood where this bubble started, if from the between the coatings and the substrate, or also between the layers.
Yeah, I think that we don't have any strong evidence of where those bubbles originate. So it doesn't seem that they're originating from the surface. I think you can imagine that now that we found out this dependence on the surface preparation and the surface quality, looking back at all the different evidence start to be a little bit confusing, and we are not 100% sure what is still, you know, a solid result and what isn't. I don't recall seeing any strong evidence of where the bubbles were originating. But of course, if somebody else that worked on this has some opinion, feel free interact with me.
Marty here. I could make a few comments on that. Yes. Going back to David's question, the usual picture in the literature for this kind of compressive delamination involves so you have compressive stress and you have some kind of weak link at the surface. There can be an Euler buckling phenomenon. If the stress is large enough, given the size of this initial weak link, then pushing on a sheet of paper on a tabletop, it will buckle, classic Euler buckling. And that would be limited to the size of the initial weak link until the stress is large enough that the stress energy, rather, in the film, which is the product of the film stress and the film squared and the film thickness, exceeds what is known something like an interface strength. That is, if the film can gain energy by continuing to grow the buckle compared to the energy it takes to pull it off the surface per unit area, then the bubble will grow, or the blister will grow from that initial Euler buckle delamination to a larger and larger blister. And then what limits the size of that blister growth is some complicated story. And as you see in this title, mixed mode cracking, it depends on a bunch of elasticity theory that's depends on parameters we don't really know too well for these films. So, so what? So I think the initial weak link can be rather small. And once you have that Euler buckling, it can then grow to nearly arbitrary sizes. You could have an initial delamination of even submicron size that can grow to hundreds of microns, for example. And so I'm not sure if chemically analyzing the surface would necessarily tell us what's going on, because you'd have to find that little initial weak link that allowed the Euler buckling to happen. And then the film, the bubble will grow typically much larger than that, as we've seen. So that's one point of complexity there. With respect to where do the bubbles start, we've begun a series of experiments where we have lithographically patterned the surface of a substrate that has bubbled, and then dry etch through that pattern so that we can see interfaces that intersect through the whole thickness of the film. So we can look in with a SEM at the edge and observe where the bubbles start. And we've gone through about three iterations of that process, progressively getting rid of stupid things we've done on the first three runs. So I won't say that we've had clear evidence yet of the initiation. Once that is, you want to intersect a small bubble that's just starting rather than one of these great big fully delaminated bubbles, because that's a complicated nonlinear elasticity thing. How does it explode once it gets so big that you see the yield stress at the edge of the bubble? That's not really the interesting regime. The interesting regime is the initial nucleation. And I hope within the next week or so, our current samples allow us to look at some weakly bubbled films where you just have tiny bubbles. And if we intersect some of those with our lithographic trenches, we should be able to see where they're initiated, rather than once it fully spallates, what that goes on there is perhaps less interesting. So I wouldn't say we have a good answer to that question yet in any systematic fashion, but we're working on it.
Thanks a lot. Clear explanation.
Thanks, Marty. I think Peter was next.
Good. Yeah, thanks, Gabriele. A few questions. I'm curious, if you go back to slide four, your slide four, it looked like there was a... On the left there, it looks like you've had at least a sample that had like 60% titania. And I'm curious what happened, the refractive index plot. How did that behave in terms of the loss angle? And the reason I ask this is we now have a multi-layer, HR stack from Lincoln Labs that is deposited with around that level of titanium concentration.
Yeah, I don't remember right now. I can't recall the numbers off the top of my head, but I can look it up and see what happened at that sample. There was some good reason that we didn't include it in the systematic. It might have been, I believe that probably that sample had, I will check and come back to you, but I believe that sample was already high enough in titania that it crystallized relatively early. So that's my recollection. But I will look. I will look it up for you.
Yeah, yeah. We're about to, you know, measure it, go out, anneal it, and measure it. So let's see. And then, can you say more? So, I mean, in terms of the surface quality, you certainly talked about the polish quality, but can you say more about how these samples have been cleaned? And have you actually seen, you know, different cleaning methods leading to different different delamination slash bubble behavior?
So we have hints that the cleaning might play a role, but we didn't do any systematic studies yet. Concerning how they've been cleaned, I will ask either Carmen or Aaron if they're on the call to give more details, because they know all the details. It's better if they directly explain that.
So the cleaning process for the majority of all these samples are a drag and drop using the methanol and acetone, and methanol. And then we did later on in the process add a etching process, which I would also a dry etching process, which I would consider a cleaning as well. But the systematic cleaning process, we haven't completed that, and that's where we're going to be testing not only a wet etch, but then also the drag and drop versus a adhesive product. So.
Okay, thanks.
I want to add something to what Aaron said. I think that in all of this discussion, you have to also keep in mind that, for example, the Supracil or the Coastline substrates that are Corning 7980 that actually we deposited for MIT, for Josh and others, they are ultra polished, and all of them may be polished in a different way. So in other words, the surface, you know, the material that is used to polish is different. So that may also affect the, you know, the adhesion. But these are all, you know, these are all studies that we are going to do now.
Good. Thanks.
Thanks very much. And just a comment on that before we go further, just from our silicate bonding experience buying super polished substrates. Actually, after a while, we discovered we couldn't bond anymore with substrates straight out of the packet with our normal cleaning procedure. And it turned out independently, both in Glasgow and in Stanford, GPB colleagues had discovered the same issue. And it turned out that perfectly clean substrates that had come from the manufacturer sitting in the packaging, which wasn't even touching the surface, was outgassing plasticizer, which was attaching itself to the surface of the substrate, and it required a more aggressive clean. They looked perfectly clean, but there were tiny amounts of plasticizer there that were inhibiting the bond adhesion. So just another thing to throw in the mix. Next, I think, was Giovanni.
Thanks, Sheila. Yeah, I have a curiosity on the measure, a direct measurement of thermal noise on the annealed sample. So if I understand well, this was done on the bubbly sample. Was that possible because you had a sufficiently large coated area not affected by bubble with respect to the dimension of the spot?
That's correct. Yeah, the spot they use is a 10 microns or something like that. Maybe somebody can correct that. So you can actually find a place where you're out of bubbles, and so nominally clean piece of the coating, but still, I mean, it's the question is how much are the bubbles everywhere affecting that?
Yeah,
but yes, that's
the question exactly. Yeah. So you need to wait for more samples.
Yeah, we were hoping to be able to fix and solve and have a stack that can survive 600 C without having so many bubbles, but we haven't been able to do that yet.
Thank you.
Thanks. And Steve Penn, I think, was next.
Hey, Gabriele, thank you for the presentation. Two quick questions. If we can assume that these bubbles are caused by stress in the coatings, Are you considering doing depositions on heated substrates?
That's one of the things to consider, but of course, as you know, it's hard to heat up the substrates in a standard spectrum machine. I think what Carmen can do right now is as high as 100 to 150 C, so it's not easy to go much higher than that. But that would be an interesting test to do eventually, yes.
I thought Stuart had the ability to go to 500, if I remember correctly, or at least higher than 100, if I remember.
Yeah, in the ECR ion beam deposition process, so it's not directly compatible. But we can certainly do studies.
And then one follow-up is... Hello?
I was just going to say, just a quick follow-up to that. We do have... The Lincoln Lab Spectre does have the ability to deposit at... I don't know. Do you know what it is, Nick? It's certainly a couple, several hundred?
I think at least 250.
Yeah. So that's something that we might try there.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's high enough to alleviate the silica stress, but it might help. Then my other question was, my understanding from Hong's paper is that the bulk contribution is weighted more heavily when calculating the coating thermal noise than is the shear. So your extrapolation, I'm just talking about the difference between your estimate for the coating thermal noise and the measurement that Nick got. And, you know, since your measurement on the GEN system, at least at the lower frequencies, is going to be more dominated by shear, I'm wondering if it might be helpful in making these measurements to get a measurement from a suspended sample, which can easily measure some of these low frequency modes that are have a much higher bulk content.
So we plan to have some measurements, some film deposited on thinner disks that would allow us to go down to 300 Hz. So that wasn't the plans, but we couldn't do that because then the priority now was to, on the deposition side, to just understand these bubble things. But we could do that and have samples with the resonant modes down to 300 Hz. That would help us see if that dependency is a frequency dependency is really confirmed at lower frequency. Concerning how bulk and shear goes into thermal noise, that's all considered because the model we are using here, as shown now in this slide, even better in this slide. So they both consider the contribution of bulk and shear loss angles in the case of the Jans ring downs and the case of the Brownian noise. And this expression here gives results that are consistent with the Hong model. So I expect that's in the all factor in. But of course, being able to measure more modes at lower frequency would be definitely useful.
Okay, if you'd like any of them measured using a suspended sample, yeah, you can just send them to me.
Thank you.
Thanks. Marty, your hand's up.
Sorry, that's left over.
Okay, no problem.
Turn it off.
$10 fine, that's all. Carmen.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment in relation to stress and how to control it in a dual ion beam sputtering system. The coatings that we deposited, the 52 layers that Gabriele presented the results and that were measured at MIT, used what we call low stress silica. We have a way to lower the stress in the silica using the assist source. And so that this coating, the silica does not have, 400 megapascal of stress. It's about a half. And we are looking at ways to further reduce the stress on the silica. And to do this, we use the secondary ion beam source to sputter the coating during deposition. And this would be equivalent to, using high temperature, but it's far more controllable. Thank you.
Thanks very much. So, Nikita.
Okay. If you go back to the slide 30, you presented the table with the density. And may I ask, did you try to reveal the role of a polishing? The slide was the correct. The table, which, yes.
Yes, okay.
My question is that, did you try to reveal the polishing role if you compare deposition with a perfect polishing or different scheme of polishing and measuring the density as presented here at the table? I see that the change of a density is quite significant. This is really evidence about the stress. If we rely on that, you can try to detect with another polishing mechanism this change of a density. And my question is that, is the difference between different polishing scheme in the density measurements?
Yeah, so that's a good suggestion. No, we haven't tried different polishing and see how that affects this change in density. All those measurements that are shown in this table are on our 75 millimeter and 1 millimeter thick discs, which have a standard optical grade polishing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, indeed, it could be done, as I understand. It's really good because the value change is quite visible, let's say. It's really not less than 1%, and the precision allows to detect such a change. Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much. Any last questions for Gabriele? No? So, Gabriele, you have a few more slides there. We're a bit over the hour. If you want to go through them relatively swiftly, since again we have the information and can come back to it, but you just want to quickly flick through those, that would be great.
Yeah, so I will just there isn't any new information in those slides than anything else that I already discussed. Just that I so since you and the panel gave us a bunch of very specific questions, I wanted to try to answer all of them. Maybe the only thing that is worth spending just a minute on is this slide here. So that we're asking questions about the extinction coefficient and related to the absorption of the coating. So here we just put together some numbers. So the only direct measurement, if you want, of the properties of the absorption of titanium dobgermania is these 2.3 ppm on a quarter wavelength stack that give you a extinction coefficient, which is of the order 10 to the minus 6. If you extrapolate the measured 40 layers or 54 layer stacks, you can get smaller numbers, just assuming that there is almost no absorption in silica. Again, I wanted to stress again that those are what we managed to get so far with a spector system or with a cutting edge coating system. So we expect that as it happened in Titania Doptantala, once we move to the final real production system, these numbers could be lower. For the other slides, I think we've been through most of the detail. I put them all of them together just as a reference for the panel if they want to take a look and reference to the slides, but I don't think there's any more information here that are worth spending a lot of time on it. And the last slide that might be useful is this one, that just all the experiments and the tests that we are carrying out now to try to understand how to understand and solve this problem of blistering, delamination, and bubbling. The most important being, as we stressed already many times, is the how it depends on the substrate quality and polishing. I think that's all, and there's a lot more information hidden in the slides that you can take a look if you can find by yourself later, I guess.
Thanks very much. That's exceedingly helpful, and thanks for all the effort on the presentation today. So I see one hand has snuck up, Ricardo Di Salvo.
Yes, when you talk about annealing halfway, would that be in the same environment or taking the mirror outside, annealing, and then putting it back for the next 26 layers?
Well, yes, you have to take it out of the deposition chamber and put it into an annealing furnace, and then you have to put it back, yes.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay, thanks everybody. That was a very interesting presentation. Thanks again, Gabriele and colleagues. And we look forward to talking to you soon. Bye just now.